For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. and British officials are telling the media there is a significant possibility a bomb brought down a Russian passenger jet over the Sinai Peninsula after takeoff from Sharm el-Sheikh Saturday, killing all 224 people on board. One U.S. official said intercepted communications point to the possibility Islamic State was responsible. A team of British aviation experts went to the Sharm el-Sheikh airport to assess security there before any British flights will be allowed to leave the region. Philip Hammond is the British Foreign Secretary.
We have concluded that we have to change our travel advice, and we are now advising against all but essential travel by air through Sharm el-Sheikh Airport. That means that there will be no UK passenger flights out to Sharm el-Sheikh from now.
Experts are examining the wreckage for any signs of terrorism, while some reports say forensic examinations have revealed shrapnel in some of the victims. U.S. air safety experts warned commercial airlines several months ago they were, quote, at potential risk associated with extremist activity if they flew over the Sinai. A cargo plane crashed Wednesday in South Sudan shortly after takeoff from the busy Juba airport, killing at least 32. A young child was the lone survivor. Reports said the Russian-built Antonov turboprop crashed just 800 meters from the runway. Meanwhile, UN experts have told the Security Council the warring parties in South Sudan are stockpiling weapons and ammunition in violation of an August peace agreement. The council has already warned the two sides it's prepared to impose an arms embargo if the agreement collapses. The experts say the government of President Salva Kiir and forces of rebel leader Riek Machar have failed to implement a ceasefire. They cited numerous incidents of rape, killings, and displacements. This is VOA News. Top U.S. diplomats say almost all Russian airstrikes in Syria have hit moderate Syrian rebels, not Islamic State targets. Assistant Secretary of State Ann Patterson testified Wednesday before the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Moscow has cynically tried to claim that its strikes are focused on terrorists, but so far 85 to 90% of Syrian strikes have hit the moderate Syrian opposition, and they have killed civilians in the process.
Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said much the same thing to reporters.
You know, they've done hundreds of airstrikes at this point. I'm not putting out the count anymore, but only a fraction of them have been against ISIL targets. And when I say fraction, I'm talking under 10%.
Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland said Russia is paying a steep price for its intervention to prop up the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. She noted that Russia is spending between $2 and $4 million a day to carry out its military effort in Syria. Earlier, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov highlighted the need to decide which of the various opposition groups fighting in Syria should be part of a future peace effort, which should be considered terrorists. He met with UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura to discuss the process of finding a political solution. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Wednesday appointed German diplomat Martin Kobler to take over the mediation efforts in the Libyan political impasse. Stefan Dujarric is a UN spokesman.
Mr. Kobler will succeed Bernardino León of Spain, to whom the Secretary General is grateful for his dedicated service and effective leadership of UNSMIL. The leadership transition will take place in the coming days. Mr. Kobler brings to this position more than 30 years of senior UN and foreign service experience.
Mr. Kobler was most recently head of the UN peacekeeping mission in Democratic Republic of Congo. After months of negotiation, Mr. León presented the Islamist-backed government in Tripoli and the internationally recognized administration in Tobruk a proposed national unity government, but members of the rival governments have so far failed to agree on a plan. In Tunisia, 30 lawmakers from the ruling Nidat Tunis Party suspended memberships Wednesday, protesting efforts by the son of President Beji Caid Essebsi to control the secular party, a year after it won an election hailed as the country's key step toward democracy. Last week, a party meeting turned violent amid tensions between the two sides, one supporting the president's son and those backing the party's general secretary. Canada's new leader, Justin Trudeau, has been sworn in as prime minister, ending a decade of conservative rule. Mr. Trudeau led his Liberal Party to a commanding victory in parliamentary elections last month, taking 184 seats to 99 for the Conservatives. The 43-year-old Trudeau follows in the footsteps of his late father, Pierre Trudeau, who held the office for nearly two decades. He's the second youngest prime minister in Canadian history. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. After a successful two-day nomination process, Uganda's Electoral Commission meets with presidential candidates today, Thursday.
We are meeting the candidates for their official agents in order to harmonize their campaign program. We do not want candidates campaign in the same place at the same time.
Jotam Taramua is Uganda's Electoral Commission spokesman. At least 36 people were killed Wednesday in a plane crash near South Sudan's capital, Juba. Three Zimbabwe journalists jailed for publishing so-called falsehoods have made bail. And Liberia welcomes the signing with the United States of a $257 million Millennium Challenge Corporation compact.
It is very significant in that the compact is about governance, and it does underscore the fact that we are trying to do our best to put the right institutions into place.
The Honorable Joseph Boakai is Vice President of Liberia. A Nigerian youth group works to change their country's drug policy, and it appears 10 Eritrean footballers who absconded in Botswana may now get asylum. Those stories plus Mark Omar's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's Electoral Commission meets today with representatives of all eight presidential candidates who have qualified to participate in next year's general election. The commission says it wants to harmonize their upcoming campaigns in order to reduce or avoid tension and possible violence that might arise if two or more parties campaign in the same area at the same time. Today's meeting follows the conclusion of a two-day candidates nomination process for the 2016 presidential election. Commission spokesman Jotam Taramua also says that official campaigning will begin on November 9th.
We had a successful two-day nomination exercise. We started yesterday, the 3rd of November, and concluded the 4th of November with eight successfully nominated candidates, in which you have the incumbent President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, the former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi, Dr. Kizza Besigye, and the other five. And tomorrow morning at 10, we'll start meetings up 8 in order to harmonize the campaign program. And campaigns officially begin on the 9th. So it was a success, and we are very happy for that.
Thursday's meeting, what does it constitute of, and why that meeting, if they've met this criteria of submitting nominations to represent each political party in next year's general election?
We are meeting the candidates for their official agents in order to harmonize their campaign program. We do not want candidates to campaign in the same place at the same time, because that would cause the clash of supporters, and it will not be good for our electoral process. We want to make sure that there is harmony throughout the campaign period. And when one is in this area, the other one is in a different area. That way we are able to control any sources of violence during the campaign period.
Let's look at when official campaign begins, because accusations that have been leveled against the Electoral Commission is that the Electoral Commission seemed to be suppressing opposition groups from meeting their leaders.
All along, Peter, our wish was, why don't you wait? We conduct the nominations, and then you can officially begin your campaign. So it is not correct that as Electoral Commission, we are taking sides and denying the opposition challengers to hold the campaigns. Campaigns were not allowed because we had not conducted any nominations. We always wanted them to stick to the law, which requires them to limit their activities to consultation. But you know, as politicians, they would want to go and campaign. And you campaign when you have not been nominated as a candidate. You campaign as who? Because candidates are the ones that are allowed to campaign. So that was not a correct complaint, and they knew it, except the Ugandans and others who could not read between the lines. So we decided to stick to the side of the law and to advise them to stick to the requirements of the law. I am glad we have concluded the nomination. Campaigns are going to begin, and there won't be any complaints of such nature.
Jotam Taramua is spokesman for Uganda's Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. At least 36 people were killed Wednesday when a Soviet-made plane crashed soon after takeoff from South Sudan's capital, Juba. It appears only a young boy is the only survivor, according to local Red Cross officials. The plane was headed to Paluch oil fields in Upper Nile. Philip Town Aleo of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program was at the scene of the crash and reports from Juba.
The Russian-made Antonov V-12 plane took off at 9 a.m. local time. Within a minute, the plane ran into some kind of trouble and began descending, according to eyewitnesses. It hit two trees before crashing into the Haigavat residential area, southeast of Juba. The debris is scattered over an area about the size of a football field. Wreckage from the plane landed less than 10 meters from Ibrahim Mohammed's house. Mohammed was farming when he saw the plane crash.
I stay here with four of my children. My children were just seated in the house, and I was out in my farm when the plane started descending, then immediately landed near my door, and one of the tires rolled to the compound here.
Mohammed says he's lucky the plane wreckage did not hit his house.
The sound was so loud because it hit a tree behind there, and I heard some sound, and the sound was so loud when I was in the farm, and I decided to run home. Thank God, when I arrived, I got my children who had also run away, and they were not hurt.
Kenyi Gala, Assistant Operations Manager of Combined Air Service, a flight company which does business with the plane's owner, says it was carrying both goods and passengers to Paluch. He believes the plane crashed because it was overloaded.
You know, we have problems some of time. Our security people can put people on their own mind without manifest. The cause is just overloading.
Stephen Warikozi, Chief Executive Officer of South Sudan's Civil Aviation Authority, says the cargo plane belongs to a company called Allied Air Service. Warikozi says the pilot communicated with the air traffic control tower just before takeoff.
Captain reported to the tower that the person on board is 12 and fuel is enough for 5 hours.
Officials say there were 20 passengers and 6 crew members on board. Volunteers and Red Cross personnel claim to have recovered 42 bodies by 11 o'clock, including several women and children. Officials say one child, about 6 months old, survived, as well as 2 men, one of them in critical condition. For BOA News, I am Philip Donald Liu in Juba.
Liberia and the United States this week signed a $257 million Millennium Challenge Cooperation Compact in Washington. Vice President Joseph Boakai and Planning and Economic Affairs Minister Amara Kone participated in the ceremony on behalf of the Liberian government. The agreement highlights the United States' re-engagement with Liberia in its post-Ebola recovery and will focus on hydropower generation, electricity sector reform, and road maintenance sector reform. Vice President Boakai says the agreement is about governance and underscores the fact that Liberia is trying to do its best to put in place the right institutions. He also said the agreement shows the United States as a true partner of Liberia.
Beside the fact that this is money coming into the country to benefit infrastructure, namely electricity and roads, it is very significant in that the compact is about governance, and it does underscore the fact that we are trying to do our best to put the right institutions into place.
You mentioned electricity reform, the road infrastructure. One criticism I hear too often when I talk to Liberians is that you know, how come it's almost 10 years since your government has been in power and there's no dependable electricity?
Well, you know, the issue of Liberia did not start 10 years ago. Liberia is 168 years old. A lot of things have happened. We inherited that problem, and it's not that We are not doing anything about it. Just about the time the hydro project was to commence, that's when the Ebola fell, and everybody left the country, and that is in the making. But apart from the hydro, there are other facilities put into place, like the HFO machines that are put into place that will be able to provide more than 40 megawatts of electricity. So electricity is on the go.
You mentioned good governance, and good governance is important for foreign investment. So how would you describe the investment climate in Liberia at this time?
Well, you know, Liberia had a sizable investment in the country pre to Ebola. Since then, we've seen a lot of these investors coming back in the agriculture sector, the oil palm industry.
Every time you read about Liberia and investment and good governance, people mention the government is not doing enough to fight corruption.
Well, you know, it will always be the case. Nowhere in the world corruption has been completely eliminated. But we know that rather than physically arresting people and putting them in jail, we are putting into place systems that we control. We know that there are people in the society who undermine the economy through their conduct. But when the law finally come to grip with those people, they have been punished. Some of them have been asked to resign. Some of them have been prosecuted. So it's an ongoing activity.
President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has always said that the government is fighting corruption, except that she says the legal process is a bit slow. Do you think the legal system is working to that extent?
When they say the legal system is not working, it doesn't mean that there is no legal system. It means that it needs improvement. It means that the judges, the courts, have to move on actions very fast. We have established specialized courts to deal with different cases so as to expedite the process. Those are all part of the development challenges.
That's Liberia's Vice President Joseph Boakai speaking with me in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 9th. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, and Radio Habel in Habel City, Liberia. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The Youth Arise Group, based in Nigeria, is working towards changing the country's drug policy towards one that addresses drug use from a public health perspective, rather than simply a criminal angle that hands out jail time and punishment. The group's program director, Adeolu Ogunrombi, tells Ricky Schreier he hopes the Nigerian government will be more open towards changing the drug laws and help users gain access to treatment, health care, and rehabilitation.
At the moment, we have a drug policy that came into existence about 26 years ago. Looking back, many things have actually changed over a period of 26 years, and the current day reality is letting us know that the challenge of drug policy or drug response within the country has moved beyond just law enforcement alone. It's a myriad of issues that borders on development, public health, human rights.
What parts of the policy do you want to change?
We should first think about public health. How do we get people safe in terms of drug use, in terms of infectious diseases such as HIV, hepatitis, and people who need treatment and care are able to access these services without being locked up within the criminal justice system. Because if you look at it, most of the communities where drug use are problematic are communities with little or no infrastructural development. If you also look at the individuals who are involved, these are people who are, whether they're out of school, they have no job doing unemployment, and they are trying to take to drug use to escape the harsh reality within the society. So these are the issues we need to confront headlong. There was a report released by UNODC that shows that if the issue of drug use is addressed from a public health perspective, crime rate is going to be reduced in the community by 50%. But what we see today is a situation whereby we prioritize law enforcement and we see everything about drug response as an issue for criminal justice system. In terms of drug trafficking, yes, high-level traffickers should be arrested. They should be punished according to the law. But we found that, look, these people are actually living freely, whereas the users, the people at the lowest cadre of socioeconomic ladder are the ones going to jail.
Can you give me a specific example, perhaps, of a law that is too harsh on punishment?
Within the law that stipulates 15 years to 21 years imprisonment terms for drug possession and consumption of whatever amount. It has a wide definition. It listed a wide range of drugs that includes, you know, cannabis, heroin, cocaine. That's actually what the law states. But in practice, based on some judges' discretion, they've not been applying this law, even when drug users are arrested and brought before the court.
That was Adeolu Ogurumbi, program director of the Nigerian group Youth Arise. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. A court in Zimbabwe has granted bail to three journalists arrested for publishing a story that linked senior police officers to a massive elephant poaching syndicate. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Despite a three-hour argument from state prosecutors, Magistrate Tendai Mawe ordered the release Wednesday of the three journalists on $100 bail each. Foster Dongozi of the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists says the three never should have been arrested at all.
Instead of seeking guidance and assistance from the journalists, we get surprised and extremely shocked and displeased at the same time when police descend into newsrooms and arrest journalists. We are expecting the police to be in the Wange National Park looking for the poachers and not in newsrooms looking to arrest journalists.
The three journalists from the state-owned Sunday Mail newspaper were arrested Monday for linking senior police officers to a poaching syndicate at Wange National Park, about 700 kilometers southwest of Harare. In recent months, about 80 elephants have died at Wange due to cyanide poisoning. Zimbabwe police spokeswoman Cherry Charamba said the three published court falsehoods, but Amnesty International said their detention was, quote, a shocking attempt to threaten freedom of the press, unquote, in Zimbabwe. The Southern African country has an estimated 100,000 elephants, but conservationists say poaching is starting to decimate the population. Demand for ivory from the elephant's tusk remains high in Asia, despite an international ban on the ivory trade. Analysts also say poverty is pushing some Zimbabweans into illegal hunting. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
It appears 10 Eritrean footballers who absconded in Botswana after their 2018 World Cup second leg qualification match against Botswana may now get asylum. Dick Befer, the lawyer for the players, says the Botswana government has assured him the players have been granted asylum status. He says they will now be transferred from the illegal immigrant center to a refugee camp.
The situation as it is now is that yesterday the Botswana government communicated that it has decided to grant the 10 footballers from Eritrea political asylum in Botswana. That would mean that the 10 football players would have to be moved from where they have been ever since they approached the authorities in Botswana seeking political asylum from the Francistown Center for Illegal Immigrants to a refugee camp known as the Dugui Refugee Camp. The information I got from the authorities yesterday was that logistical arrangements were being undertaken for that exercise.
Have you represented them in court from where they are? I guess there are reports that they are in a prison facility.
Yes, they have been, in fact, not quite police custody, but they were kept at an illegal immigrant center in Francistown, north of the capital city, Gaborone. That is where people who seek asylum in Botswana are kept. We have previously, approached the authorities so that we are allowed to pay a visit to the footballers, and that was pursuant to an order of court. granted by the High Court, affording the representatives or the legal representatives access to these individuals.
What will be the next phase after getting a granted asylum?
The wish they have expressed to us is that they would like to pursue the profession as footballers, and that as long as the intent at the refugee camp, they will not be able to advance and pursue their profession. Therefore, we will be making representations on their behalf to the relevant authorities that they should be allowed to stay outside the camp and be allowed to work as professional footballers. The minister responsible does, in fact, have the power to consider and to grant an application of that nature, and it is our hope that such an application will meet favorable consideration from the minister.
Dick Befro is the lawyer representing 10 Eritrean footballers who absconded in Botswana after their World Cup qualifying match with Botswana. He was speaking with Ezra Fesheya of VOA's Amharic service. It's time now for the rest of Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with the disability sports. Egypt beat Libya 99-38 in the men's event at the Africa Wheelchair Basketball Championships in the Algerian capital Algiers on Wednesday. South Africa edged Morocco 65-60 as Algeria outplayed Nigeria 75-40. In the women's matches, South Africa overpowered Morocco 48-8 as Algeria edged Nigeria 48-45. Early on Tuesday, Nigeria overwhelmed Morocco 99-2. Turning to football, Cameroon's four-time Africa Footballer of the Year, Samuel Eto'o, and FIFA Chief Medical Officer, Professor Jiri Juvorak, completed a tour of Sierra Leone and Ghana to experience the progress made in the FIFA health campaigns FIFA disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland on Wednesday. In Sierra Leone, the 11 Against Ebola initiative started last year was to address the Ebola outbreak emergency. Now that the World Health Organization is set to declare Sierra Leone Ebola-free tomorrow Friday, a new campaign, FIFA 11 for Health, is set to get underway in Sierra Leone. Eto says the new program is aimed at harnessing the power of football and scientific research to inspire young girls and boys to lead a healthy lifestyle. In Ghana, Eto and Juvorak noted the progress made, where over 20,000 students, 600 teachers and 300 schools are benefiting from the FIFA 11 for Health initiative. In Egypt, the suspension of certain countries from the men's Africa under 17 and under 20 competitions has been lifted, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, disclosed in Cairo, Egypt, on Wednesday. 10 countries pardoned in the under 17 age group are Benin, Burundi, Central African Republic, Guinea-Bissau, Kenya, Liberia, Libya, Mauritania, Sierra Leone, and South Sudan. The five countries pardoned in the under 20 category are Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Equatorial Guinea, Lesotho, and South Sudan. Consequently, all 54 CAF member associations can now compete in the qualifiers for the 2017 Africa Under-17 Cup of Nations due in Madagascar and the Africa Under-20 Cup of Nations set for Zambia. Finally, in Chile, Mali play Belgium in the first semi-final at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in La Serena today, Friday. The second semi-final features a showdown between defending champions Nigeria Golden Eaglets and Mexico in Concepcion. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A plane has crashed in South Sudan shortly after taking off from the busy Juba airport, killing at least 36 people. That's it for this Thursday, November 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, our sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.